What's the last book you read?
Probably a Hardy Boys book.
Oh my gosh, are you for real?
Yeah. Well, from cover to cover.
Well, that's how you read books, Jeff. Cover to cover.
Not words, in high school. Chapters. In high school, you get the chunks that have just enough info to like write the paper.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're not a big reader these days.
Not these days. I don't know. It just fell off.
Oh my gosh, we got to get you back on that train again. The Hardy Boys are good though.
Yeah.
I do love them.
Boxcar Children too.
Chet, remember Chet and his like fancy roadster? Okay, so I am the opposite of you. I love to read, and I easily read at least one book a week, sometimes more. And one of my favorite authors is Emily Giffen. She is a New York Times bestselling author. She writes mainly books about female relationships. So back in the day, they called it chick lit. You don't really hear that too much anymore. She has sold 11 million copies of her books, 9 New York Times bestsellers. She debuted with a book called Something Borrowed, which, do you like movies, Jeff?
I do like movies.
That one was made into a movie. Kate Hudson was in it. She's super cute.
Was it a chick flick?
It was kind of a chick flick, but perhaps Mrs. Jeff might have dragged you to that one. Her latest is called All We Ever Wanted. And this book is really interesting because you would think she wrote it in the last 6 months based on things happening in our world right now. It is a book where she talks about racism, classism, sexism, lots and lots of isms. But the interesting thing is she started writing this story back in the summer of 2016. And by 2017, Me Too had exploded and many different racially charged incidents in our country were happening. So the book coming out now has generated all these really great conversations with people. So we're going to talk to her about her latest, All We Ever Wanted, and we're going to find out what it takes these days to be a critically successful author, translation, to be able to earn a living doing it. And she is commercially successful. So we'll find out how much of a job it really is to be an author. I always like think romantically you go up to an attic and you just sit by yourself and you never have to like do your hair or get dressed. It's not like that anymore. You have to be a brand. And she is all over Instagram. So we'll find out more about that. And then also the other interesting thing about Emily is she used to be a lawyer. And she went from working in the law in New York City to getting out of that profession and taking a chance as a writer. And I'm always fascinated by people who throw a really good career away, not throw it away, but make a change, make that pivot. And what did they know that made them so confident that they should take that leap?
So bottom line, what's the one thing that you're dying to ask?
What I'm dying to ask is how critical is the author as a brand to the process? And if you're somebody who wants to try something like this, what do you need to know now? Have you ever wondered, how did they do that? I'm talking about the art of the follow-through. I'm Deirdre Fitzpatrick, and Dying to Ask is the podcast that gets me off a TV news set and into candid conversations with authors, entrepreneurs, and influencers I have been dying to talk to. So brace yourself. This is a verbal gut check about what it takes to go from idea to reality. And who knows, maybe along the way, you'll get some answers to questions you've been dying to ask. Emily Giffen, thanks for joining us on the Dying to Ask podcast. We're really excited to have you here.
Yeah, I am too. I'm really excited to talk with you guys.
You know, I am excited that you were able to take a break from stalking the royal family to chat with us for a few minutes. I would think it's a full-time job.
It's always in my heart and soul, the royals.
Jeff,
do you get it? Do you get the obsession or not really? You can tell the truth.
I can understand it, but I wouldn't say I'd participate in it.
You don't?
The fact that you can understand it, I think, says a lot about you. I had a huge fight with my best friend from law school. His name is Brian. And, you know, we're still the best of friends. But when Diana died, he refused to understand even why I was so sad. He's like, people die all the time. And I'm like, come on, Brian. Like, come on. Like, if you really can't see that watching someone get married, watching someone get a divorce, watching someone have two children, watching someone struggle with bulimia, and then watching someone die, like see the footage of their last moments alive. If you can't understand that that's different than a random, like, you know, shooting in some city, like, I'm sorry, I can't help you. You didn't expect to start the talk this way, did you?
He didn't expect it to be so heavy. But let me tell you,
I like that you just said you at least understood it.
Well, he's a sensitive man, and it's probably because his wife is going through a master's in a counseling program right now. He's been schooled a little bit. Yeah. Yep. True story about Princess Diana. The night that she died, I was working in Des Moines, Iowa as a weekend anchor. 10:37 is when the news started to come in that this might have happened. So I turned to my co-anchor, who is twice my age at the time, and I said, Steve, this is really big. We should break in. Because, you know, we were going to break it from Des Moines, Iowa. And he looks at me and goes, nobody cares about that. He was like Brian. He was just like your Brian. He says, nobody cares. This is not a story. This is nothing.
Wow.
He picks up his briefcase and his box of pyrotechnics because he used to make fireworks at his desk. True story. On the weekends while we were supposed to be doing the news. And he walked out. And then it turned into, of course, one of the biggest stories of the decade.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
That's crazy. He might be a step worse than Brian because as a journalist, he should have at least understood. He was a journalist, you said?
He was a journalist, but then you might have missed the part where I said that he made fireworks at his desk during his break.
I heard that part.
You did hear that part. Okay, that troubled me too in retrospect.
It didn't trouble me as much as not understanding that Diana's death was significant, but.
Well, no. There are priorities. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to your priority these days, and that is promoting your latest book. It's called All We Ever Wanted, and it is just off and running, already doing incredibly well on the New York Times bestseller list. I've been following you, the Royals, all the stuff you're talking about online, and your book tour that you're coming off of just looks like it was ridiculous fun.
It really is. They're exhausting just because the pace of them, but they're so much fun. It's so great to interact with readers because writing is so solitary, you know, and you create these stories sort of, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel is the book coming out, which isn't so much just the book coming out. It's the fact that people are reading your stories and you get to meet them on the road. It's just, I love it. And, you know, I understand that not a lot of authors don't enjoy that part, but I think it's so fun to connect with people in that way.
This time around, what I thought was really fun, because I stalked you on Instagram, is to see that you brought your daughter along and your daughter's out.
You stalked me on Instagram.
Yeah.
Look at this. You see her?
That's Dolly the dog. Jeff is like, how do you know these things? Because I stalk her on Instagram. Oh, hello. Yes. So cute.
She's watching very quietly.
Good.
Yes,
like
I did
that.
Take my daughter. Her name is Harriet, and she's 11. And I have trouble fully understanding why she wants to go on these book tours, but she enjoys them. And I love having her because it makes me, you know, I don't get homesick when I have someone from home with me. And so it's great. We enjoy it, but I publish every other summer. So this book, my next book will come out when she's 13, and I'm kind of thinking she might be over it by then.
13's a tricky age. I mean, 11, you're still pretty darn cool.
Yeah.
I wish you luck with 13, but no, you know that.
But you know what? It's more that my readers are pretty damn cool. So they're so fun, and she interacts with them. There's always a few people who very nicely come up and ask her to sign a book because they follow me on Instagram and see her pictures. And so I think she enjoys that. But it's fun. Book tours are fun.
So the book is called All We Ever Wanted. My first question I have about the book is why is the name of the book in lowercase?
The title?
Yeah, why is the title of the book in lowercase?
Well, you know, I think just as far as like mixing up the typography to make it a little more interesting, that have the name in capital letters and then the title in lowercase. I also think like originally I did my everything in lowercase, and you know, we sort of as my you know, characters have grown up. So have I grown up, and the subject matter has, I think, you know, evolved somewhat. And it's just a little bit more serious look to put my name in the capital letters. And I think we just decided to do the lowercase to sort of tie it in with the look of the former covers so that there's a strand that sort of ties together. All of this was none of it was random, in other words. So it's a good question.
Well, that's kind of my point. That's really where I was going with it, is that it's interesting to me that something that is so subtle actually has this really, has a lot of gravitas to it. And there's a lot of thought that goes behind it.
Yeah, and I care about my covers a lot. So we do a million different versions. It was actually my idea to do the cobalt blue.
Very nice.
The cover was like a purple, and I saw a peach version of it. But I really I love this color. I think it looks grounded, but still pretty.
Jeff, what's your favorite part of the KC Ray app?
Probably the weather.
The weather, because?
I need to know if I need to wear boots or, you know, sandals if I could wear them.
It's a footwear thing for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like knowing something before I head out the door. I need to know things. If I'm going to read them out loud, I need to know a little something. So that's the first thing I do, is I look at the app. I see what happened overnight. I get myself caught up. So when I walk in the door, I sound smart.
Sounds good.
It does, as long as you read it. KC Ray app, it is free. It's in the app store. It's like having KC Ray in your pocket.
Who wouldn't want that?
People who don't want to know things.
Obviously.
not listening to this podcast. Emily, all we ever wanted is a story about racism, classism, sexism, lots of the isms. But the interesting thing is that while people who read it today might think that you wrote it in the last 6 months, given where what's happened in our country, you didn't. And the story of these characters has so many interesting parallels to things that we're talking about these days.
Yeah, you know, when I set out to write the book, when I started writing the book, it was late summer of 2016. So I published books every other summer. And then when I return home from a tour, I just sort of, you know, take a few weeks and try to think about what I want to write and, you know, just come up with the characters and a premise and the story and just kind of go from there. And so originally I knew that I wanted to tell a story about a woman who had to choose between her own family and her most deeply held values. And, you know, what would you do if you had to choose between protecting your child and sort of doing what was right? And I think that's a fascinating premise to me, and one that I've thought about, especially as my children get older. And I have twin boys who are now 14. They're going to high school next year. And so these various issues will come up with their friends and so forth. Nothing that's in the book, but they make me ponder, you know, that those emotions and those issues. And so then I started to write the book, and I came up with the characters. And, you know, first there was Nina, and then Tom and Lila. And as the story developed, those issues that you talked about, classism, racism, elitism, privilege morphing into entitlement and so forth, they sort of seeped their way into the plot in a way that I didn't set out to do that. But I think with hindsight, I can look back and say, you know, they were such a part, and they still are, they continue to be, but such a part of the national conversation. Even, you know, back in the summer of 2016, the months leading up to the election, you know, and I make a point to say, Nina, who's sort of, I consider the main character of the three, even though the book's told from three points of view, you know, I made a point to say that she's not political. That's because I envisioned her not being political, but also I think it was important in that there are no, I'm not making a political point in my fiction and through my characters. I create characters and then I try to stay very true to who they are. So these issues work their way into the story. And I do think with hindsight, I can see that it was what was on my mind. It was what, you know, it's the conversations we were having around the dinner table with my children, and is what you would hear when you turned on the news at night or, you know, TV, and you would just have these conversations with your friends. So I think that definitely informed and influenced the plot of the story.
So for people, I hate spoiling plots for people who haven't read, I hate telling people the end of the movie or the end of the book. So let me just, for people who haven't read it, and producer Jeff has not read it.
He will,
The synopsis, yes, he will by this afternoon. I don't know why he didn't read it last night. You have these kids who are at a private school, kind of well-off school. There's a party. Kids get drinking. Girl gets drunk. Appears in a partially clothed picture with a son of well-off parents. Son posts picture with racially charged caption on social media. Dun, dun, dun. And that's where everything kind of explodes from there. And bringing the element of social media into it is such a big difference from when you and I as Gen Xers were growing up, when young producer Jeff here was growing up. Well, no, you probably always grew up with social media, huh?
Social media came about in my high school days.
In his high school days. What a little baby
he
is.
I was out of law school. I was, you know, I had MySpace when I wrote my first novel. I remember the top eight?
Yes.
Like, who's in your top eight?
Yes.
Very important. That was eight around.
Was Brian in your top eight?
Brian has never been on social media to this day. I don't think that surprises you.
It does not.
Facebook, maybe LinkedIn, which is the one that I'm not on. But you set up the premise exactly right. I mean, the boy made a choice to send something out to some friends, and it, you know, it spread as these things do. And the father, his father's inclination, who his father grew up in a decidedly, you know, silver spoon way, elitist way. He had a lot of money, a very well-to-do family with a good name, a good family name, which Nina.
It's a loaded statement, isn't it?
Yeah,
a good
name. What does that mean? mean? Like
a good family. Kid.
Like he's a good kid from a good family. It's like, well, is he a good kid from a good family? And what makes a good family? You know, so that's, I think, a little side conversation that happens in the book, throughout the book. But yeah, so I think his instinct and inclination is to make this go away. Listen, it was a mistake. Boys will be boys. Let's not penalize him and jeopardize his whole future for this one mistake. And I think the exaggerated, you know, people asked, did I see something in the news, so forth. And I didn't. However, one of the stories that I did go back to in my mind as I wrote it was this Brock Turner Stanford swimmer, which is a much more extreme, you know, criminal version than what happens in the book. And therefore, I think somewhat less interesting to examine because it's sort of like a bright line rule. Like he raped a girl behind a dumpster. Like that's, you know, just so bad. But yet even his father made some comment when he was like making his testimony to the judge about it when in the sentencing portion of that hearing of that trial. And he said something like, well, should my son's entire life be ruined based on a couple of minutes of bad decision making? It's like, yeah, dude, it should. To be, yeah, just, I really feel like I'm talking to friends. Can you tell?
but you know, Emily, it's true. Because and the Brock Turner story with us being out here on the West Coast has been a huge story for us. But those words that you're using, they're not indicative. They're not only to that particular story. You hear that a lot. And I'm curious to know, when you went out on these book tours, because the subject matter kind of went beyond love and marriage and kids and maybe cheating, and it got into these much more serious topics that we're talking about in more serious ways in our real lives, did that change the questions that you got from your readers on the book tour?
No, I mean, I would say I totally understand where you're coming from, but I would say, you know, questions in relationships about in your marriages and your deepest friendships can have the same weight. I think that the stakes have increased because the characters are older and they have children. But you know, I think I've explored a lot of the terrain that's like, what would you do? God, I don't know what I would do.
Have you run into people just within your own little community? Because once you have kids, your community becomes school and sports in many ways, who have said, is that so-and-so?
Yeah.
Well, is that a problem?
No, I would say not so much like that, but more of a plot point where it's like, you got that from this. And it's like Ruby Tuesdays, you know, there's probably someone who got a DUI leaving a Ruby Tuesday. So that's frustrating sometimes to explain to people. There is a finite number of plots in the world, you know, and you're going to have to borrow this from various points of, but never has anyone said that's me or that's so-and-so. You know, and that's because it hasn't been.
Let's talk a little bit about the writing process. I'm curious to know, you mentioned that you try to put out a book every other year. So you go on the book tour in the summer, you come back, and is it like you sit down at your desk, you start banging things out, or do you need a while for something to come to you?
Yeah, I don't start banging things out for sure. It takes me a while, and I'm in that sort of stage right now. So I'm very happy to be talking to you for more than one reason, because it justifies my day. I'm doing something productive and fun when I should be banging out the next book. But no, I mean, I have ideas of sort of threads and different things that I want to explore. And typically that just, it'll all sort of come together, but it takes a while. It takes a while for me to get there.
Do you find now that you'll be heading into your 10th novel, do you find it easier because you know eventually it will come, or is it just as challenging?
That's such an interesting question. Do you write fiction? I know you write in your job, but do you?
I have three unfinished novels.
By the question, that you're a writer.
I know, and I'm just kind of. I think it's interesting that sometimes, like, you have the confidence of knowing, I know I'm going to pull this off. Like this podcast, I know we're going to do a decent job in this podcast.
Yes.
Because I know that I have a good track record. You have an amazing track record. You've sold 11 million books. You have 9 that are already out there on store shelves. 9 that will soon will be on Jeff's shelves at home because I know he's going to race out to go buy them.
Well, just one. Just one on the
shelf. But do you find comfort in that, or is it just as terrifying when you sit down? Because now that you have huge expectations of people, no pressure. No pressure at all.
Jeez. No, I'm kidding. So, yes, I would say it's both. I mean, there's every book is harder than the one before it because I put more pressure on myself and I want to continue to write a book that I think is, you know, better than the one before it, which isn't to say that every reader will like it more, but that I feel like more proud of from a sort of a professional technical standpoint of I did a better job with this book. And so that just raises the stakes and the pressure that I put on myself. But at the same time, it's very interesting that you said it because that's exactly it. I just remind myself, you felt this way before. You know, you just have to get started. And that's reassuring to know that I've conquered those feelings before. I think that's, you know, not to get all, you know, touchy-feely, like self-helpy, but I think that's so true about life in general. Like, it's just like, get started and believe in yourself, whatever it is you're doing, and just take it one step at a time. I think so often we get overwhelmed by, you know, wanting to be perfect or wanting to achieve so much or, you know, wanting the relationship to be perfect or the job, you want to be, you're here and you want to be here. You just have to sort of get started. So, it's hard though.
It is hard. You know, when I write television scripts, the first words that I write are the ending. I write my out cue. I write, I write Dear to Fitzpatrick, KCRA News, because I like to know where I'm heading. That's the ending. That's where it will end. And then I work my way backwards.
Yeah. I like that.
It seems to work. Tell us a little bit about what your writing process is like. Once you kind of have the idea, what's a typical day like?
I'm very slow. I'm a very slow writer. So
what's
slow? So I publish every other year. I really have to work 40 to 50 hours a week to make that deadline to finish that. So, I mean, I've read authors who are commercial writers who publish every year and they only write maybe 3 or 4 hours a day, which isn't to say that I'm writing every minute, but I'm sort of sequestered and like, you know, trying to write, trying to not be on social media. It's probably more like it, more accurate. But so I usually in the morning, so I don't know what kind of detail you wanted, but I have 3 children. So I get them to school, take them to school, come home, kind of get organized, maybe work out, maybe not. And then I go to an office. Like I used to work in my home and I can't do that anymore. There's too many temptations, especially with the kids being older and more fun and more interesting to talk to. So I go to my office and then I usually begin the day by revising what I wrote the day before.
On a typical day, how many words or how many pages would you have written?
It totally varies. It really
interesting.
Does. Sometimes it's like not, you know, it's zero, and sometimes it's, you know, I guess at the most it would be maybe 1,000 words, which would be like a lot for me, but maybe even 1,500 words. 250 words is this double is one page double spaced. So, yeah, 4 to 6 pages would be a lot, but. And it's because I'm a perfectionist, so I want it to be good as I go. I think that if I could ever sort of let go of that, I could just write and then go back and revise it, whereas I revise every morning. And I think the reason that I've done that is because if I don't revise what I've done the day before, I can spend a whole day with nothing to show for myself. And that's one thing that's very different. I used to be an attorney and, you know, that was, if you put in 8 hours of work, you'd bill a client for 8 hours. You would have 8 hours of work to show for it. And that's just, you know, just not the case with writing fiction. So that can be frustrating, but.
Do you outline your plots as you go?
No, you don't. So I have a very general sense of beginning, middle, and end of the storyline, but that changes as I go, as I write, as I get to know the characters. So it would be, akin to this. You know, we've met twice. You and I have met twice, and I feel like, you know, I'm getting to know you, and I know certain things about you. And I, you know, if you were my character, if you were exactly my character, like, I would guess certain things about you. But then as I got to know you, I'd be surprised. You know, I'd be surprised by certain things in your life, because none of us are just types, right? Mm-hmm. We're not just one thing or another. So that's kind of what happens, is I get to know the characters, and as I put them on a page with each other and a scene with each other, and they interact with each other, I get to know them better. And so then it's like, well, no, she would never do this in this situation. She would do this. So it just, and then when you change what she's doing, it sort of impacts what everyone's doing. And then the story changes direction. So often the end won't really resemble what I expected it to be.
Did you know that I turned down the job to be the morning news anchor 3 times at KCRA?
Why would you do that?
Because I wanted nothing to do with early morning news.
Ah, yes, I can understand this.
But clearly something changed.
Clearly.
Because I saw the light, and lots of you have too. Our morning news is now on for 5 hours a day. We start at 4 a.m.
That's a long time.
It is a long time. In 5 hours, I could drive to Bakersfield. I could run a marathon, go home, eat a pizza, and take a shower. Or I could get caught up on everything that's happened in Northern California while you were sleeping.
I think there's one obvious choice here.
One obvious choice, and I'm really glad I finally said yes on that 4th time. Let's talk a little bit about just the whole publishing process, because it, like, in the time since you started this, you know, many years ago, it has changed wildly. So what from when you started out to where it is now, what are some of the things that you think people would be surprised to find out?
Well, let's see. I think a lot of people don't think about the marketing side of it, and the trends and marketing and how important that is. So, you know, I know that it takes tremendous, you know, luck to be published. I mean, you have to be reasonably good at what you do, particularly if, you know, I'm 9 novels in. Clearly it wasn't just like a complete fluke, but, and I work very hard. And I've always worked hard. That's just sort of a trait that was born with and that I've cultivated along the way. But at the same time, luck is such a huge, huge, huge component. When I look back, and I wasn't able to see it then because it's hard to see things when you're in them, but, and I wrote Something Borrowed. It was 2001 when I started it, and then 2002 when I finished it, and 2004 when it was published. Well, at that time, the genre of chick lit had exploded. You know, we had Bridget Jones' Diary, Devil Wears Prada. So when I turned my book in, it was actually called Rolling the Dice. And the book was dark in some ways. I mean,
Rolling the Dice, really?
Yeah, because of that scene when she rolls the dice. It's sort of about letting fate, you know, taking control of your own fate. But if you think about the book, if you divorce it from the big screen, the movie mm-hmm. that we all saw, where it was like much funnier than my book, and you take away the cover, the pink cover with a diamond ring and the title Something Borrowed, really, it's a bittersweet book about, you know, a friendship imploding and a girl doing this drastic thing. And, you know, it's sad. It's bittersweet at the end. It's melancholic at best. Mm-hmm. But I can see that they marketed it as chick lit because that's what was selling.
Right.
And so I was the beneficiary of writing a book that could be marketed as such in a time when they needed these titles. So I think if I had written Something Borrowed 5 years earlier or 5 years later, I don't think we'd be having this conversation right now.
Such an interesting thing. And the other thing that happened after that, and this is probably because of social media, is this whole concept of the author as a brand. And really, yeah, all of us, in no matter what field we do, as a brand. And certainly because of your really huge social media presence, and because you are such an engaging person, that has really also, I would think, been a great advantage for you as a writer. And how important is that? It sounds exhausting, truthfully.
Yeah, no, you know, it's fun for me, and it drives my kids crazy. But my Harriet's right in there in the mix with me. But I don't think that's something that you can fake. I think if you enjoy it, you know, I think you can tell when someone's running your account. I mean, there's other things that I should be doing that I don't like to do.
Can authors make it if they're not a voice on social media these days, if they're not out there as a brand?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, there's plenty of examples. Curtis Sittenfeld, for example, she tweets, but she's, you know, she's not on Instagram. I think she might have a small private Facebook account, but yeah, I think there's all kinds of examples of successful writers who don't. But I think it does help.
I'm wondering, is one of the questions that you get asked a lot about the fact that you made such a major life pivot? We've talked a little bit about how your former life was as a lawyer. And you've been really public about saying, you know, I went into law. I already knew I really wanted to be doing something else. But at that point, I kind of had to stick with it for a while. So can you explain kind of like what that was and then how you made that decision?
Yeah, I guess in my own head and heart, it feels less drastic than it looks on paper. Because I always knew I wanted to be a writer. And I wrote from the time I was 5 or 6 years old. I wrote little poems and stories and submitted them to Cricket Magazine. I know.
I remember that.
Yes. I don't think I ever got anything higher than third place but I got a lot of honorable mentions, which
was
nice. But I entered those contests and I just, you know, I always said I want to be an author. I want to be a writer. For a while, I wanted to be a sports writer. When I was in college, I thought seriously about going in that direction. But writing has always been a huge part of who I am. We also moved around a lot when I was a kid. My dad worked for Sears. And every 2 years, I went to a new school. So I was very introverted and just found solace in these books and these stories and these characters. So books have always been tremendously important to me. My mother's a retired librarian, so books have always been important to us. So it's really the real question, if you know me well, would be like, why did you go to law school? Not why did you quit to be a writer? But, you know, I think that I fell into that trap, and my characters have often fallen into this trap. It's a theme. It's another theme that's sort of recurring of making a choice because you think it's what you should do rather than what you really wanted to do. And, you know, I had, I'll just brag about myself. I had a 4.0 in college. I did very well in school. I love school. And it was like, okay, well, I can take the LSAT and do well on that. And like, then I did. And then I got into got into a bunch of good law schools. And so it's like you fall into that. I think it's a trap that we all fall into life. Like when it comes to a lot of our decisions, it's like, what should we be doing? Or what looks the most impressive? Or what will society gauge as the most successful? Or what will your parents approve of? And I think people can make relationship decisions based on, you know, oh, my mother's likes him better than him. Or, you know, this job is more impressive or this school.
So how long did you work as a lawyer?
5 years.
Was it miserable the entire time?
Yes.
And I come from a family of lawyers, so I come with a little bit of background on like what the actual day in, day out is like in law. Yeah. And it's challenging. It's not all like Ally McBeal much.
Well, you know, and I don't want to penalize all of the legal profession for this. That was my fault, too. So when I graduated from UVA, like I could have gone into something that I really would have found interesting. Like, you know, I could have gone to work in the DA's office. I think I would have loved that. And then I might not be writing. But again, I chose the law firm job because it was the most prestigious and it made the most money. And I felt like, you know, I also had a ton of legal debt, law loans to pay back. So I sort of chose, you know, the oppressive law firm culture, Manhattan law firm, litigation department. And so, you know, I think that looking back, I could have made other decisions, but I would also say, although I hated the, I hated practicing law in a big firm culture in New York City. There were wonderful things about it. I don't think I would have moved to New York City if I hadn't had the security of this sort of a job with this kind of a salary. And, you know, I don't think I would have moved to New York to write a novel. I think I would have moved home to write the novel. And so there's benefits of moving to New York. And, you know, I made friends at my law firm who mm-hmm. remain my closest friends. So life is, even when you think you're making a mistake with whatever it is you're doing, it's not a mistake. There's always good things that come from it, is what I'm trying to say.
And so for people who, I would imagine people ask you though about this from time to time, like what's your big advice on how to know when you've reached that point where like you make a leap like you did, where your gut's telling you like, I really need to be doing something else, but.
I think that people, we all know what's right inside of us. It's like, if we can learn to listen to that voice, we have those answers. I think it's just hard because there's so much other noise involved. There's so many other pressures and again, these expectations of what we think we should be doing. And I, you know, I just think that if we really listen to our gut, we'd get to a happier life, a more fulfilling life faster. It's just easier said than done.
Most definitely. It'd be nice if you could look out like 10 years and then, you know, make that decision. Make it a lot easier. So what's next for you? I know we need to start wrapping this up, but what, obviously like getting back to that computer and not spending time, you know, half the day with me is probably not on the to-do list, but what's next? What do you see yourself continuing to write novels? Do you have different types of writing you'd like to take on? What's your dream here?
No, definitely novels are just my priority, like to continue to write the next book and the next one after that and keep going as long as I can. But at the same time, we are developing a television show that's the announcement hasn't officially been made yet, but it's based on my backlist. It's based on all the books except for Something Barred and Something Blue, which we still hope that will be made into a film. But I'm working with the same production company that did Something Borrowed. Actually, she switched and started. It's too complicated to explain. Basically, we're developing a television show.
That's
exciting.
I'm not good
at describing this yet because I'm still not supposed to be talking about it. But it'll be based on multiple books, and the books, the characters will all, you know, occupy, live in the same world in Atlanta. And the stories will, the one season will be one book, and then it'll bleed into the next season and the next book. So
that is really exciting. Congratulations.
Oh,
that is really exciting.
It's so, everything that happens out there on the West Coast is just, it's so, so many different things have to happen. I mean, you got to write the pilot, they got to pick it up, they got to, you know the drill.
Yeah. We have to go surfing in the afternoon, then we talk about it, then we have some drinks, and then we you get back to work. And maybe we'll have a royal baby to look forward to in the next year.
I was going to say, the common thread will remain. My true priority is, and I really have to brag here for a second. So one of the things that I'm most proud of.
You are familiar with the term humble brag, right?
Yeah, but the humble brag isn't that. This is like covert brag. This is like the get ready.
Okay.
I think the humble
I'm
brag.
Ready.
Okay. Overt brag. I guessed Princess Charlotte's full name 2 days before she was born on a website. So there's like proof of it. I guessed that she would be Charlotte Elizabeth Diana. And I said it with such authority. Charlotte Elizabeth Diana. Charlotte was really the thing that I like guessed because I thought it went the best with George. You know, I went through all the possibilities. I'm like, it's going to be Charlotte. But then I thought, they have to include Diana's name, but they can't include Diana's name unless they include the queen's name. And if they include both, they have to put Elizabeth first. So I said Charlotte Elizabeth Diana, but then I said with authority, because I figured if you're going to do it,
go all in.
Yeah. So I'm like, I'm 100% sure. I said, I'm 100% sure that it's going to be Charlotte Elizabeth Diana. And I said it and I wrote it and I went around the house telling my kids, and that baby was born Charlotte Elizabeth Diana. And I swear to this day, my kids wonder if maybe like I didn't get an insider's call from the palace.
Or if you're a witch.
Yeah, or that. Either way.
Here's what I think. I think if anybody's going to name a baby after Diana, it's Harry. Because Harry doesn't care.
Yeah, but they already did it.
I'm talking about Harry. Like, but first name. They couldn't use the first name again? They always reuse names in that family. Yeah, they have like 15 names they can choose from.
It bothered me about Louis. Like, it's the first name and then a middle name. He doesn't care. Well, I mean, clearly he doesn't care. Clearly. He's clearly not following the rules. But
That's why we love him. That's why we love him.
That's why
And that's why I love you. Thank you, Emily.
Love you back. Thanks, guys.
All right. Appreciate it. Best of luck. Thanks. Can't wait to see the TV stuff that you're working on. And, of course, that next book, Get On It. Emily Giffen's All We Ever Wanted is available in bookstores now. And if you want to keep up on all things Emily and, of course, the royal family, follow her on Instagram. You'll find her at Emily Giffen Author, on Facebook at Emily Giffen Fans, on Twitter at Emily Giffen, and her website is emilygiffen.com.